welcome to a special edition of our show, Herstory
on the Rocks,
with Katie
and Allie.
So normally it would just be Allie and I. We'd be having some drinks and we'd be talking about women in Herstory. But sometimes we like to interview women who are making Herstory.
Yeah, so today we're having on a very special guest, Kimberly A. Hamlin. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kimberly is an author, historian, and professor, and also a columnist for the Washington Post. And we've invited her onto our show to talk about her new book, Free Thinker, Sex, Suffrage, and the Extraordinary Life of Helen Hamilton Gardner. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I'm a professor at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, and my expertise is in women's history, especially U.S., and I mostly write about women, sex, and politics. So I have a lot to say. I teach classes about women's history, sex, and gender. And in the fall, I proposed a new class on Me Too, the historical and cultural context. So I'm super excited about that too. And that's mostly what I write about for the Washington Post, is historical context of stories about women, sex, gender, and politics.
Oh, great. Yeah, that's where I actually first came upon some of your work earlier.
Oh, okay.
This March, I retweeted the article, The Problem with Women's History Month.
Oh, thanks.
And I was like, wow, this is such a great article. And to sum up for our listeners, you know, it's about how women's history should be integrated all year and not just like set aside for one month. So before we dig deep, and I guess you said a little bit about this already, but what types of contributions do you make to the Made by History series in the Washington Post?
I mostly write about women, sex, and politics and try to provide historical context. So the first time I pitched them was, do you remember when Roy Moore was running for Senate in Alabama?
People yes.
Were like, oh, wait, but he likes to seduce teenage girls. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that Helen Hamilton Gardner worked on, which we'll hopefully talk about later, was working to raise the age of sexual consent for girls. Mm-hmm. Pitched him was, oh, like this has a longer story of how states one by one tried to make it illegal for grown men to have sex with girls, which is a fascinating story. So that was my first one. I've also written about the historical context of women testifying before Congress about sex. Mm-hmm. When the Brett Kavanaugh hearings were going on.
Right.
And that one, I liked the title a lot. It was called What Happens When Women Testify Before Congress About Sex. And then it was basically like nothing.
Yeah.
So no one listens. Yeah.
Well, thank you for making your contributions, because I think that if we don't put these current situations in historical context, sometimes we miss the greater point and we miss the fact that this has been happening for a really long time and no one's doing anything about it. So thank you for your contributions.
Thank you for helping share them and tweet.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is your second book too, correct?
Correct. Yes.
Okay, so I think let's kind of start out with a little bit of a physical description of Helen Hamilton Gardner, because, you know, obviously she had a general upbringing in like the Virginia, Maryland era. So if you could kind mm-hmm. of paint a little bit of a picture for us, like was she of a high socioeconomic status? You know, what did kind of her early life look like?
Helen Hamilton Gardner's early life was really framed by the Civil War. So she grew up as a Chenoweth of Virginia, which was, you know, a slave-owning first family of Virginia. But she was born in 1853. So when she was just one, her father, who was a minister, moved everybody to D.C. so that he could emancipate the people that they owned. And then shortly thereafter, they moved to Indiana. So she had grown up hearing these stories about like her rich relatives or what it was like to be a Chenoweth of Virginia. But they never really, her family never really had any money. She moved around a lot. Everyone dies basically during or because of the Civil War. So she has this like taste for finer things and an appreciation of finer things without ever actually having them. So was sort of her class status. The first time she feels comfortable in terms of money was when she's in her late 60s. But she kind of ran in, you know, richer circles without ever having real access or real, you know, a sense of comfort or security. What she looked like physically was she was very beautiful and very small. Those things that people always said about her, that she was very petite. So her lover called her wee wifey. they were not married, so only half of that is true. Yeah. She was not his wifey. She was about 5'1" tall, and for most of her life, she weighed just about 100 pounds.
Wow.
Very small. And she had dark brown hair and dark brown eyes. And that was another thing that all of the, you know, people who saw her speak or wrote up reviews of her speaking mentioned were her, like, her searing, dark, beautiful eyes. Mm. Also looked much younger than she was, which worked both for her and against her. So some of the images in my book, you'll see, like, when she first started speaking in public, she was 30, but she looks about 12. So worked against her because people kind of dismissed her, like, who is this, you know, 12-year-old on a speaking tour? But then when she was older, or even into her 70s, people thought that she was in her 50s. So she tells this one funny story of when she was civil service commissioner going to the President Harding's White House, and one of Harding's staff members said, "Oh, Mrs. Gardner, I stuck up for you the other day. Someone tried to tell me that you were almost 70. And I told them that if you were a day older than 50, I would eat my hat." And like, well, you better prepare for a diet of felt.
Yeah.
So she was very beautiful, youthful, charming, vivacious, and petite.
Yeah. Well, I think it's so interesting right off the bat that you start off the book with her being from Virginia, but really only being born there, because you mentioned that she was talking to a president and he, like, wasn't listening to them. And then they bonded over the fact that they were both from Virginia.
Yes.
I just love those little facts of, like, you know, she's yes, technically she's from there, but she really lived a life all over.
She barely ever lived in Virginia, and it wasn't until she settled in Washington in, like, about 1910, when she bought a house with her husband, that she began kind of playing up this Chenoweth of Virginia heritage. She had done it earlier in her fiction, but she didn't really claim it or act it out until she settled in D.C. and found it was, in fact, very useful to be Chenoweth of Virginia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she actually, being that her last name was Chenoweth, like, her original name wasn't Helen either. She was born Alice and then had to change things around because, as you kind of mentioned a little bit earlier, she had an affair with a married man. So if she hadn't have moved and changed her name, what would it look like for her to be staying in a place, you know, if she had just stayed there after that affair? Would she have had a successful life?
That is such a good question. So when she had the affair, she was 22, 23, and she was living in Sandusky, Ohio, and her name was Mary Alice Chenoweth, and she went by Alice. And the newspapers printed her name, and she was forced to resign from her job. So all over the state, people knew her name. So she was run out of town, and that was really, being a teacher was pretty much the only way a person could support, like, a middle-class white woman could support herself. So that was it. So she could not have sustained. I mean, she maybe could have married in some other state where maybe people didn't know her or couldn't find her in, like, a pre-Google.
Yeah.
This move. But in terms of supporting herself, no.
When I first started reading the book, I, you know, read about this affair, and I thought that was kind of going to be it for him, that she was going to face all the consequences, his life wasn't going to change. And then as I kept reading, he just kept popping up, and it's like, by the way, they're still together. And I, like, I couldn't believe it. So can you just dissect their relationship a little bit for us?
So her lover's name was Charles Smart. Mm-hmm. And so she had an affair with him. And then they end up eventually living together for 25 years as if they're husband and wife. And what I think the draw is that she was passionately in love with him. And he, as far as I can tell, you know, loved her too, but he didn't provide any of the things that, like, a 19th century husband was supposed to provide, like security. Mm-hmm. He was constantly struggling to keep his job, to not get fired. He, you know, she was always worried that he, you know, couldn't keep a job, couldn't keep any money. So he didn't provide the sort of normal husbandy things, but I think she just passionately loved him. And I think she was really drawn to him, you know, physically. He was very tall, especially for the 19th century, more than 6 feet tall, very handsome. And I think it was sort of a, like, passionate first love. And I think also because they had such a scandalous affair, that somehow their secret bonded them together. Like, if we don't stick together, what was the point of having this scandal in the first place? So I think that was another part of it. And I also think that he supported her intellectually. And whereas, you know, traditional husband may not have. So mm-hmm. he did say, you know, great, speak about whatever you want to talk about. You want to critique the Bible? Sure. Talk mm-hmm. about sex? Great. What do I care? I've made it possible for her to live the life that she wanted to have.
It definitely seemed like that type of relationship gave her a certain sense of freedom. It like also grounded her because she had to be married or like, you know, pretend to be married to operate in certain social circles.
Exactly. It gave her sort of a license to say, oh, like I am respectable. It is okay that I am, you know, saying all these unacceptable things in mm-hmm. society because I didn't look how normal he is.
Right.
So it did provide her kind of a cover of respectability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And where did that kind of drive come from in her? I know she went to a couple like university courses and she became a teacher after going to a normal school. But like, where did her feminism and her like anti-racism come from, do you think?
Quick clarification. I would not say she was anti-racist. That is the one, you know, kind of mystery about her of why
okay.
she did her way through racism. But her feminism, and we can talk more about that, but her feminism, I think, came from a very early age of watching her father and her brothers be iconoclasts, sacrifice everything for their beliefs. And I think she wanted to do that too. But for her, she saw that the main limitations placed on her life were because of a woman, because she was a woman, and because of the sex scandal. So this scandal is really what starts her on this feminist journey, because she sees that the consequences for her are so different than the consequences for her lover, who basically doesn't face any consequences. So that, I think, was her central question. And that's why I think she's such an interesting figure and kind of a suffragist for the Me Too era, because it was really the sexual double standard that starts her on her life of feminism.
Yeah, and she starts kind of writing these books, and she has this literary, you call it a literary doppelganger named Florence, and she would write these fictional books to promote like her views and her ideas. So what sort of ideas was she trying to get across in those books she was writing?
I think she was trying to point out just how challenging heterosexual traditional romance was for women in the 19th century. That was her central kind of theme, that women were judged unfairly kind of no matter what they did. If they had sex, they were judged unfairly. If they didn't have sex, they were judged unfairly. And she wanted to paint the picture of the limited number of choices women had with regard to men and just kind of living their life.
Mm-hmm. And one book that seemed really interesting and frankly timely to me was, Is This Your Son? Is This Your Son, My Lord? Because one of the things you say about this book is that women thought the crimes Gardner displayed were realistic, commonplace, yeah. even while some men denied such horrors existed. So in this book particular, what was she exposing?
She was trying to paint the picture that for men, premarital sex was kind of a given. People had this boys will be boys attitude, and that it was very normalized for especially like upper class white men to seduce young girls of kind of lower class or prostitutes. And that was considered totally fine. Parents, teachers, educators, even ministers said, fine, this is not fine, that this has deadly life-altering consequences for women. So that was kind of the message in that novel, and also her second novel called Pray You, Sir, Whose Daughter. Mm-hmm. So she was writing about premarital sex, the sexual double standard, and then she kind of came to hone in on the age of consent issue that I touched on earlier. Mm-hmm. Huge reform effort in the 1880s and 1890s, whereby this mostly temperance activists joined together to try to raise the age of sexual consent for girls. So in 1890, it was 12 or younger in 38 states, meaning that if you're a grown man and you have sex with a girl, you could say it was consensual if she was 12 or 10. In Delaware, it was 7.
What?
That was something that shocked me. I could not believe yeah. it was 7. And that was one of my questions was, so she's trying to reform this. Why? What was the benefit of having the age of consent so low? Was it just because the men who were benefiting from it were the ones doing it and the ones that yes. were in charge?
Yes.
Just that simple.
Yes.
That's so frustrating.
And also she wanted to point out that, you know, no one knew she was a fallen woman herself, meaning that she had sex outside of marriage, before marriage. But for women, mostly that would be the end of your life. You had asked earlier, like, could she be a teacher? Like, no. I mean, that would be the end of your story. So she's, you know, she knew that it wasn't just like the rape and sexual abuse of it, although obviously that's bad enough. It's also that that would be the end of the woman's life. And most reformers would say, and this may or may not have been true, but reformers would say that once a girl had quote unquote fallen, meaning lost her virginity, the only path open to her was prostitution. Mm-hmm. So they saw that as like a pipeline, you know, all these young girls would be seduced by older men, lose their virginity and be quote unquote ruined for anything else except for prostitution. So that was what she was trying to stop. And so she advocated things like, you know, a single sexual standard that men and women should behave the same. And that in terms of prostitution, the male Johns should be, you know, punished, arrested, not just the prostitutes or not even the prostitutes at all. Mm-hmm. So that was her message. And that was really, I think, where she learned politics, which she later brought to her suffrage lobbying, were her efforts to get the age of consent raised in so many states.
Mm. And I think that's it's interesting that when she was doing this sexual consent, you know, law change or working towards that, she had to pair up with Anthony Comstock, who I think we as feminists think of as like the ultimate villain. But she made it clear that she wanted it done for very different reasons. So, you know, he wanted it to be illegal because it's immoral. And she's like, no, it should be illegal because women should have like rights to their own body and they should have legal protection. So was that a struggle for them to work together?
So I don't know that they worked very closely together. They would sometimes at conferences together. She worked more closely together on the age of consent things with women's temperance activists. And she also those were not her people.
Yeah.
HHG, as I call her, was a free thinker, meaning she was agnostic / atheist. So she did not like these Christian ladies going on and on about the Bible. And she also did not support temperance. She thought that that was not a useful reform, that people should be allowed to make their own choices. So her efforts to raise the age of consent did bring her into company with these purity reformers who were not really her people. So whenever she went to their conferences or participated in their meetings, she always kind of signaled that through her speeches. And that's kind of, I think, what you were just referencing was, you know, I came here to talk about women, not about the Bible. And then she also would say things like, you know, it's not this, that women's, you know, bodily autonomy, the right for women not to be raped is not a religious issue. She said it's really, you know, a moral issue. It's a matter of law. And we should really respect women's bodies because women are people.
Right. And I'm so glad you mentioned the Bible, because there's also something that kind of seems to follow her throughout the whole book, which is the woman's Bible.
Yeah.
And I felt like there are always these women who are like, hey, do you want to work on this? And she's like, I don't know. So what was the woman's Bible, and what were these other women trying to accomplish with that? And was HHG against it, or did she just not care about it?
That is, you're such a great reader. You're picking up elements of the story. Thank you. So the Woman's Bible was the brainchild of Elizabeth Cady Stanton, you know, this 19th century feminist leader, intellectual leader of the women's rights movement. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton, you know, after decades of working first for abolition, then for women's rights, came to believe that the Bible was kind of the root cause of sexism, basically. So she thought her biggest contribution to women's rights would be to point this out to all the other people that, you know, the reason why they've had such a hard time convincing men and also women that women were people was because of the Bible and what it says about, you know, the origins of gender difference and women more broadly. So the Woman's Bible was her project, and she wanted to pull together all of the sections of the Bible that mention women, which, by the way, is not that much of the Bible. And then all these leading women from various religions, she wanted it to be kind of like an ecumenical gathering of sorts, where women would then write like commentaries on each of these biblical sections or stories about women. And so she kept trying to recruit people, but this was so controversial. So basically only a small handful of people would ever agree to participate. And one of those was HHG. HHG from the get-go had been very forward-thinking with regards to religion. She wrote her book called Men, Women, and Gods years before Stanton tried to publish the Woman's Bible. So HHG was one of the first people to sign on to what Stanton called her revising committee. But the Woman's Bible really tended to splinter the women's movement, and especially the suffrage movement. So Elizabeth Cady Stanton's colleagues in the suffrage movement thought that she had really gone off her rocker, that she had taken it too far. You can't be critiquing the Bible. So it was hugely controversial. And in fact, when it was eventually published, the National American Woman Suffrage Association at their annual meeting narrowly passed a resolution censuring the woman's Bible, saying, hey world, we, the suffragists, are not on board with, you know, Elizabeth Cady Stanton's Passion Project. We do not agree. Mm-hmm. So it was very controversial. And that was pretty much, Elizabeth Cady Stanton was on the outs with the suffragists from the 1880s onward, because all she really wanted to do was talk about the Bible and how marriage was legalized prostitution.
Yeah, well, and I'm glad you brought that up too, because one other thing that really fascinated me was that her and Elizabeth Cady Stanton had this weird pact that they would donate their brains to science when they died. And of course, that ended up not happening for Stanton. But yeah. What can you describe her fight with, what was his name, Williams, about the brain thing? Yeah.
Yep.
Can you describe that fight and why they felt the need to make this pact?
Yes, I would love to. And that's, in fact, how I first met HHG. So I first met HHG when I was looking for examples of women using science for feminist purposes. So I was sitting in the basement of the Perry Castaneda Library at UT Austin, where I got my PhD, just like flipping through the pages. And I came across all these letters from a woman named Helen Hamilton Gardner, and she was writing them in Popular Science Monthly magazine, back and forth with this leading neurologist, William Hammond, who had been Surgeon General during the Civil War. He was the founder of the American Neurological Association. So I was like, who is this woman that nobody has ever heard of, who has the, you know, nerve to write this, you know, leading neurologist? So Hammond had claimed that women's brains were inferior to men's in 19 distinct ways, and that this explained why they couldn't have careers or professions or be intellectuals or go to college. And so HHG said, you know, I'm no neurologist, but this makes no sense. And
right.
Professional. So she conducted her own investigations by working with other neurologists, especially this guy, Edward Spitzka, in New York. And so she came to kind of logically disprove all of Hammond's claims about women's brains. And the reason why Hammond's claims about women's brains were so influential is not just because of his own stature, but also because the leading women's rights kind of question or issue in the 1870s or 1880s was, can women go to college? So all these colleges and educators would turn to people like Hammond and say, well, the leading neurologist, Hammond, says women's brains can't handle it, ladies. So sorry, but you can't come to Harvard. So that was kind of the why they were so impactful. So Elizabeth Cady Stanton had already been friends with HHG, and she got really interested in HHG's brain research. So she invited her to deliver it as a speech at the 1888 International Council of Women, which was the sort of first gathering in the U.S. of all the world's leading women. Mm. She delivered this speech, Sex and Brain, it was called, which later she published as an essay. And in it, how women had trusted science only to be met with pseudoscience, why it was really important for women to engage with science, how Hammond was so wrong in all of his theories. And then her kind of, you know, ta-da at the end was, hey, ladies, did you know that when scientists talk about women's brains, they only have what she called hospital pickups, women who had died alone or in insane asylum. She said those are the samples that they use of women's brains. And they compare them against like the leading male scientists. So it's not even an apples to apples comparison. Even if there were sex differences in brains, how would we know from these samples? So she said, ladies, you know, I need you to donate your brains. And she said, I think I know where some amazing specimens could be found when people like my friend Elizabeth Cady Stanton are done with theirs. So she convinced Stanton to sign a brain bequest form to give her brain to Cornell, which was the leading brain collection. It was called the Burt Wilder Brain Collection. And Stanton said, sure, take my brain. You know, she kind of, I think, was excited to think that hers would be the first, you know, the first, they called it, educated woman's brain to be studied. But then Stanton's heirs, when she died in 1902, denied that their mother had ever made such a gruesome bequest. They thought this is too weird. And they called HHG Heathen Helen. And they said, you know, this is crazy, like Heathen Helen idea, and there's no way we can honor this bequest. Mm-hmm. Which devastating news to HHG because she really wanted there to be once and for all a scientific record of the brain of a woman intellectual.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting that they were so close because, you know, as you were talking, they differed on some opinions, which I feel like all the suffragettes kind of faced.
Yes.
Because she's working with them. And then, you know, they kind of start to push women of color out of the situation. And, you know, I think we have that one damning letter, or there's probably many, but, you know, she says, you know, it could cost the group all that we have gained and more. And, you know, she says it will ruin us. So, and but then her father wanted to free slaves and she grew up like, this is weird, you know.
Well, it's the biggest critique of the suffragette movement that it was really, you know, like, ended up being like, well, it's got to be us first and then we'll figure the rest out later.
Yes.
And obviously, as we kind of alluded to earlier, she was a part of that.
Yes. So the central question there is why, why didn't white women work more closely with black women? They see, especially because the origins of women's suffrage, you know, in the 1830s, 1840s, 1850s were in the abolition movement, universal suffrage, one for all for one. So how is it that, you know, a generation later, the white suffragists basically, you know, tell the black suffragists to kick rocks and you're on your own? HHG is a part of that in the sense that the letter you reference was with regards to the 1913 suffrage parade that she planned with Alice Paul to disrupt the first inauguration of President Woodrow Wilson in D.C. And so the question was, you know, should African-American women be allowed to participate? And this was a, you know, controversial issue. And HHG said, you know, I don't think so, because it's been so hard to get this permissions for the parade that if people think that, you know, we're asking for something beyond women voting, and here she displays a real blindness to the fact that black women are also women, she thought then everything will be lost. And the reality that the suffragists are facing in the 1910s, and especially after the election of Wilson, is that both houses of Congress and the White House are controlled by Democrats, which in that context meant Southern Democrats. So former slaveholders, you know, Confederates and their sons and brothers. And so these are the people that they have to work with to get the 19th Amendment through Congress. And the men in Congress, by this point, by the 19-teens, don't really care about women voting. So if you look at their speeches, at their floor statements, no one is saying things like, women are too stupid or too fragile to vote. That was kind of a generation earlier. By the 19-teens, they're only talking about black women voting and about black men voting. I previewed in a Washington Post op-ed last year, and it basically, all they're talking about is the 15th Amendment, which extended the right to vote to black men after the Civil War. So congressmen, not just in the South, but also in other regions, were very afraid that the 19th Amendment would not only enfranchise black women, but also compel Congress to enforce the 15th Amendment, which it had not done since 1857. So that's sort of the larger context in which white suffragists, including HHG and in black women, basically.
Yeah. And I saw in some of your writing that she was referenced as like the most potent factor in getting the 19th Amendment passed. And yet so few people know her name. Are women's rights so fragile that like even taking somebody who has a little bit of baggage that, you know, we can't acknowledge them? Because I mean, Elizabeth Cady Stanton like is a, you know, model of like, let's just put her in the forefront because she's so great. And then you take somebody like HHG and it's like, you know, she's got this little bit of baggage behind her. Let's kind of push her to the side so it doesn't taint the image.
Well, actually, I would say, I mean, most of the white suffragists, including Stanton, also have the same or similar baggage with regard to race and racism and unacknowledged white privilege on their part. So I think the thing about, I think your larger question is like, how has HHG been forgotten? And is it because of this, you know, her racism? And I would say no, because many of the other white suffragists that we do remember were also racist. The reason I think that HHG was forgotten is twofold. One, what made her the most potent factor were her behind the scenes negotiations with President Wilson and members of Congress. And because they were behind the scenes, they weren't necessarily like in the newspapers or covered in memos or official records that were readily accessible. So when people went to tell the story, they didn't necessarily see her. It's only kind of behind the scenes that you see her. And second of all, because of her scandalous life, she kind of kept a low profile historically, meaning in her will, she mandated that all of her papers be destroyed. So that's a tough challenge for historians to kind of, you know, it was tricky to tell her story when she had mandated that all of her papers and letters be destroyed. So I think in some ways she wrote herself out in an attempt to keep her scandalous personal life a secret, which she managed to do throughout her whole life. And so I honestly feel sort of bad, you know, sharing it with you now.
Yeah. And I think I was referencing more of that than racism, the fallen woman thing.
Yeah, I
think that yes. kind of background or baggage kind of, obviously you're saying she got rid of all of her own history,
yes.
but that's definitely a reason that it's like, hey,
totally.
We're not going to pinpoint this woman because the world wasn't ready yet. Obviously she wasn't even ready yet to let people
exactly.
know.
Exactly. If people knew it would have, they would have said, aha, I knew it. I knew those women's rights ladies were all floozies or, you know, it would have been, she would not have been the face if that had been known. You're exactly right.
So what kind of style, can you tell our listeners like the style of the book, like the way that it's written stylistically so they know what they're diving into?
So I tried to write Freethinker as an engaging, you know, life history. So it's written mostly chronological, in three different sections, according to what her name was at the time, because it's really a story of HHG and her self-invention over many years and multiple times. So the first part is when she's Alice Chenoweth, the second part is when she's HHG, and the third part is called Two Calling Cards, because she got married in 1902 to this Civil War hero and moved to DC. And I think she was very conflicted internally about this. Like she had before kind of been her own person and had her own name. And now she's supposed to be this like Civil War hero's wife. And so illustrating that, she even had two calling cards made, one that said Mrs. Colonel Selden Allen Day and one that said Hamilton Gardner. And sometimes the DC society pages would even print back-to-back entries saying like, oh, on Sunday, Mrs. Selden Allen Day went here. And on Sunday, Helen Hamilton Gardner went there. Like, so it's a study of her search for identity and autonomy. And also, because her life tracks nearly exactly with the women's rights movement, she was born in 1853, and she dies in 1925. Women got the vote in 1920. I also tried to provide context, you know, about the women, like, what were women's lives like? What did it mean if you were a widow? What did it mean if you got pregnant? What did you know about sex? What did you know about birth control? To kind of paint the picture of like, not just her life, but what was it like to be a woman during this time period? And what did make some women join the women's rights movement? Hmm.
And I think that's so interesting too, because I love that you tracked her name change, because we talk so often on the show about how women in history are stripped of their names, whether it's because they need to change it or whether they lose it in marriage or whether people just don't care to record it because they're just Mrs. somebody else. And
Mrs.
I love
John Smith.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And I personally love that because, again, we talked about the freedom she had when she was kind of pretending to be married. And then she does marry this, you know, this colonel or whatever it was. And then they go on all these adventures and they go around the world, but she still kept her name for the most part, which I just think is so fascinating.
Yes. And that, you know, I love that about her. And she even had like two separate bank accounts in DC, one with her the husband's name. She was very attuned to that. And even on her gravestone, she ended up being buried at Arlington National Cemetery. And even on her grave, you know, if you walk through, as I did this past fall, Arlington National Cemetery, it's all his wife, his wife, his wife, you know, Smith and his wife, Bob Jones and his wife. And she had not only her full name, but both of her names. You know, it said Alice Chenoweth Day and underneath it, Helen Hamilton Gardner. So to the end, she insisted on all of the names.
I love that. That is so cool.
So what if there's one thing that you want people to know so they can go out and buy this book? Like if you're interested in this, go out and buy this book. What would it be?
I would say that it is the ways in which women's political autonomy has always been linked to their bodily autonomy. So through this book, you can see one woman's search to be able to say what she does with her own body, when and with whom, and also to vote, to have a say in government. So she also dies as the highest ranking woman in federal government. So she goes from fallen, disgraced woman to national symbol of what it means for women to be citizens. And right. I think through her story, we really see women's participation in politics has always been fundamentally linked to our desire to have control over our bodies.
Mm. Where can people find this book?
You can find this book anywhere that books are sold. So you can buy it from IndieBound if you want to support your local bookstore. That's what I did. And you could buy it from Amazon. You can buy it via Norton. So I have links to all of the places you can buy the book on my website, KimberlyHamlin.com, or you can go to whichever favorite bookseller you have.
Yeah. And do you have like a Twitter or an Instagram where that people can follow you, your writing?
Yes. I am at Professor Hamlin on Twitter.
Perfect. Awesome.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. This was so great. And we loved your book. It was so good and informative. I just think it's fascinating she kind of reminded me of Forrest Gump. We're like,
oh my gosh, that's so funny you say that. You know, I had that in some of my book proposals.
Oh really?
Before I didn't, it's not in the book, but in my proposals, I said, she's like the Forrest Gump of the women's rights movement. She's right. The things.
Yeah, she really is. Cause then like she's going through and then she's talking to like Edith Wharton and you're like, what? Yeah. And like there's just so many things.
She's friends with all the people and at all the things.
Yes. Yeah. So thank you again. This was so much fun. And, you know, we can't wait for everyone to go out and buy your book and learn more about Helen Hamilton Gardner.
Thank you so much, Allie and Katie, for having me.
Take care.
Bye.
Listening to Her Story on the Rocks. We are independently produced by 1986 Entertainment and proudly recorded in Baltimore, Maryland. If there's a woman in history you would like us to cover, you can email us at herstoryontherocks@gmail.com. You can also message us on Twitter or Instagram. We post all of our cocktail recipes on Tuesdays so that you can go get all the supplies you need and drink along with us. See you next week. Bye.